Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our final 3CM Traverse Mount 15 seminar of Meeting Last Term. And we've got a very fitting speaker to round off our programme for this term. I'm delighted to introduce someone who some of you will have already heard of, Professor Horst Eidenmiller, who is the Freshfields Professor of Commercial Law at the other place, the University of Oxford. And tell you a bit about Professor Eidenmiller, for those of you not familiar with his work. He joined the University of Oxford initially in 2009 as a visiting professor and took up the prestigious Freshfields Chair for Commercial Law in 2015. He's also a professorial fellow at St Hugh's College. Professor Eidenmiller has worked at a number of institutions in the past, including the University of Münster and also Munich University in his native Germany. His main research areas are contract law, company and bankruptcy law, and also alternative dispute resolution. He's also been a member of a number of expert committees. He's advised the European Commission and the German government on issues of company and insolvency law reform, as well as acting as an arbitrator in a number of commercial disputes. Professor Eidenmiller today is speaking within 3 hours of one of his main areas of expertise, which is insolvency law, dealing with an extremely fundamental but also very intriguing question, which I'm excited to hear more about, which is what is an insolvency proceeding. So without further ado, I will hand over to Professor Eidenmiller.
Well, thank you, Mark, for this kind introduction. Thank you for inviting me over to Cambridge. Now, this is a very broad question, as has already been said, and in fact, I'm going to narrow it down significantly to a very specific set of problems within the context of cross-border insolvency laws and the question under which circumstances insolvency proceedings should be recognized by other states in the world. Now, the background to this theme of my talk and also to the paper that I'm working on right now is the fact that worldwide restructuring laws are gaining importance, and there are a couple of trends that we witness. For example, these proceedings usually are initiated pre-insolvency. Usually there's no insolvency administrator involved, so these are debtor-in-possession proceedings for the most part. And sometimes only certain classes of creditors are affected, so it's not the case that all creditors are affected by these proceedings. And that has made the question, what is an insolvency proceeding, actually more acute. The question can be put on a couple of different levels. You can ask the question, what counts as an insolvency proceeding under a particular legal instrument, for example, the recast European Insolvency Regulation. That's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the normative question, what should properly be counted as an insolvency proceeding? And as I'm going to tell you in a minute, this relates to cross-border settings. Now, what's the relevance of this question? There are at least two aspects of it that I think are relevant. First of all, it has a relevance for what can be called the theory of insolvency law. Basically, the answer to this question determines the scope of the subject. And therefore, the question also on a deeper level, which problem does insolvency law seek to address? Westbrook and others, for example, have put forward a view that's, I think, widely held, and insolvency law has to do with a collective response to debtors' general default. And this issue of collectivity is going to resurface in the course of my talk. Now, it's not only relevant, this question, with respect to the theory of insolvency law, also even more importantly, of course, for legal practice, because it determines the legal consequences that are related to the characterization of a proceeding as an insolvency proceeding. So, for example, in a cross-border setting, one of the main consequences under the recast and also under the original European Insolvency Regulation, if you've got a main insolvency proceeding, is that it is universally recognized by all other member states automatically without further ado. So that pretty dramatic consequences related to characterization of a proceeding as an insolvency proceeding. Now, as I said, you can pose the question both in the domestic but also in an international context. And my focus here is on the cross-border context. So I'm interested only in the normative dimension of the question in a cross-border context in Europe and, of course, beyond. And if you narrow down the question, such as I've done, then it can be restated precisely as the following question, which is more specific than the very broad question that you see on the topic, the announcement. Which proceeding should, so this is the normative dimension, in a cross-border context, this is the international context, be characterized as insolvency proceedings such that their effects merit immediate universal recognition? So it's an issue about the justification for something to be considered to be of a character that the consequences of the proceedings should be universally recognized without further ado. Now, when using the term recognition, I am using a strong form of recognition, or a concept of a strong form of recognition that we find, for example, in Articles 1932 of the recast European Insolvency Regulation, in the sense that the effects of the proceeding are legally translated into other jurisdictions immediately without the need of further proceedings in the country where the effects are to happen. So there's no need for ex aequato proceedings, judgments recognizing the effects as valid. Now, if you take that sort of strong form of recognition as the base, then, of course, that includes a more weak form in the sense of a requirement for assistance of proceedings in another jurisdiction, such as, for example, under Chapter 15 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code. I'm going to come back to that. Now, what are a couple of practical consequences of answers that you give to that particular question? So, some of the consequences would relate to existing proceedings that we see worldwide. So you can ask the question, for example, whether the UK scheme of arrangement is an insolvency proceeding for the purposes of international recognition of its effects. Same thing with respect to Chapter 11, same thing with a couple of French pre-insolvency proceedings aimed at rescuing a financially distressed debtor, the Procédure de sauvegarde accélérée, Procédure de sauvegarde financière accélérée. Let me give you an idea about what in detail I would like to do. I plan to proceed in basically three steps. First of all, I'm going to give you a quick overview over existing approaches to the characterization problem. I'm going to look at the European Insolvency Regulation, the Unsettled Model Law, and Chapter 15 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code. I'm going to do that even though my main interest is in the normative dimension, so what should be counted as an insolvency proceeding, because the existing approaches give us a feeling as to what currently is being considered to be a proper ground for characterizing something as an insolvency proceeding. And it's going to emerge that the conceptual foundations are pretty shaky right now. So nobody seems to have a pretty clear idea about why something should be considered to be an insolvency proceeding with the consequence of universal recognition of its effects. And then I'm moving towards a second section in which I'm trying to sketch a new approach to the characterization problem. And I will make a distinction between what I call fully collective proceedings and not fully collective proceedings. Fully collective proceedings are those proceedings that in one way or another affect all creditors of a debtor by restricting the enforcement of the creditor's claims, either procedurally by imposing an automatic stay on all creditors, or substantively by, for example, allowing creditor rights modifications even against dissenting creditors who object. So the key to understand the issue here is this distinction, I think, between fully collective proceedings and not fully collective proceedings. Once a proceeding is fully collective, it should be considered, for the purposes of the question that I stipulated at the beginning of my talk, as a insolvency proceeding with the consequence of worldwide automatic effects once it is initiated. And I'm going to conclude with summing up the main thesis. Now let's move swiftly through what we have out there with respect to existing approaches to the question, what is an insolvency proceeding? Here is Article 1 of the recast European Insolvency Regulation. I've highlighted in red those terms that are key to understand what the European lawmaker has in mind when talking about insolvency proceedings. You see, proceedings must be public collective proceedings. And what is public collective? All or at least a significant part of a debtor's creditors must be affected by the proceedings, then based on the laws relating to insolvency. And then there's a third criterion, which actually is branched out in three sub-issues, namely that a debtor is divested of its assets and an insolvency practitioner is appointed, that the assets and affairs of the debtor are subject to control or supervision by a court, or, that's cool here, is key here, a temporary stay of individual enforcement proceeding is granted. So what we need basically is a collective proceeding in the sense of all or significant part of the creditors, some kind of laws relating to insolvency, and then one of the three further criteria that must be fulfilled. What the European lawmaker also says is in recital 16 that proceedings based on company law that are not exclusively designed for insolvency situations do not qualify. That is a reference to the English scheme of arrangement. It's also not listed in Annex A of the recast insolvency regulation, and therefore it is not within the scope of the European insolvency regulation. What's interesting is to compare the approach of the European Commission and the recast insolvency regulation with its approach in the draft restructuring recommendation that was proposed last week, actually on Tuesday. The idea of the Commission was and seems to be that basically the European insolvency regulation and the restructuring recommendation, or the restructuring directive as it now has been proposed, dovetailed perfectly, in the sense that those proceedings that the Commission recommends or mandates that the member states adopt under the now proposed directive would be within the scope of the recast European insolvency regulation. I mean, that is the only thing that makes sense. If the European lawmaker has changed the application of the scope of the European insolvency regulation to include all kinds of pre-insolvency proceedings, et cetera, and then mandates that the member states adopt some kind of model restructuring proceeding, and that model restructuring proceeding would then not fall within the scope of the recast European insolvency regulation, that, of course, is not what the Commission has in mind. Unfortunately, it's not going to work out as the Commission believes, I think, because if you look at the proposed restructuring directive, same thing with respect to the restructuring recommendation, you see that there are a couple of differences with respect to features of the restructuring directive that are hard to reconcile with the recast European insolvency regulation Article 1. And one of these points of divergence is, for example, that the restructuring directive pushes towards more informal, quick and fast proceedings that are not necessarily public, whereas for insolvency proceedings, according to Article 1 of the European Insolvency Regulation, the opening decision is key to understand it. So there is actually a significant friction with respect to these two instruments. Now, if you try to make sense of all this, Article 1 of the European Insolvency Regulation, as it has been recast, and the new restructuring recommendation in its draft form, and how the proceeding is supposed to be looking like that the member states should adopt as the most efficient restructuring proceeding, then it appears, that's at least my view, that the European lawmaker doesn't really have a clear concept or theory with respect to what should be characterized an insolvency proceeding in a cross-border setting and why. It is rather the case, I think, that the European lawmaker proceeds kind of inductively. It checks the European landscape of proceedings that are out there and then tries to come up with some kind of working definition as to what would be an insolvency proceeding according to Article 1 and what makes an intuitive fit and what doesn't make an intuitive fit. This is a pragmatic approach, and of course it is perfectly sensible for a lawmaker that has to work on the basis of political compromises. From a scholarly perspective, however, of course, it's not a really satisfying state of affairs. If you and join me moving forward and look at other texts that we have out there, existing approaches, for example, the Ancitral Model Law on Cross-Border Insolvency, That is 1997. We've got Article 2 with a couple of definitions of what a foreign proceeding is. Again, I highlight in red those elements of the definition that are key. Collective appears again, pursuant to a law relating to insolvency, like in Article 1. The assets and the affairs of the debtor are subject to control or supervision by a foreign court for the purpose of reorganization or liquidation. It's pretty similar to the recast Article 1. However, there are subtle differences. For example, it seems to be the case that at least the Unsertral has in mind only fully collective proceedings. It doesn't mention explicitly that proceedings might only affect certain portions of the debtor's creditors. And it is not the case that control or supervision by a foreign court with respect to assets and affairs of the debtor is only one out of three possible routes into becoming an insolvency proceeding. It is necessary. It is a mandatory requirement. So it is pretty clear that the scope of the European Insolvency Regulation as recast is wider than the scope of the model law. And that's not surprising. It's not surprising because, of course, the recast European Insolvency Regulation was drafted against the background of this international trend towards pre-insolvency and debtor in possession proceedings, whereas the Unsertral Model Law was drafted against the background of more classical insolvency proceedings in the 1990s. It's also interesting to look at what especially U.S. bankruptcy courts have made with respect to the Unsertral Model Law, because in the United States, with the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act, the U.S. lawmaker has adopted the model law, and U.S. courts, of course, have been since then struggling to get a grip on the various criteria. So the key definition in Chapter 15 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code adopting the model law is paragraph 101.23, and you see it, and again, I've highlighted in red the crucial elements of the definition. They are pretty much the same as in the model law, but what is more important is what the courts have made out of certain of the elements, namely especially the collectivity requirement and the requirement that it must be a law relating to insolvency, the adjustment of debt. And I'm going to give you two decisions here. The one is Bankruptcy Court District of Nevada, 2009, and Rebet Corp. And there's no need for us to go through all the elements that the court has checked. I just want to highlight basically two here. First of all, the collectivity criterion. The court reflects upon what that means and comes up with the idea that a collective proceeding is one that considers the rights and obligations of all creditors. And then it says this is in contrast, for example, to a receivership remedy instigated at the request for the benefit of a single secured creditor. A voluntary winding up fits this collective criterion. So with respect to the approach on the face of it, it is pretty strict. So it must be a proceeding that affects somehow the rights and obligations of all creditors. But what that means actually is pretty vague, because the court says a collective proceeding is one that considers the rights and obligations of all creditors. So that's kind of unsatisfying. Unfortunately, the Bedcorp case has been adopted, as we can see later on, in the jurisprudence of other American bankruptcy courts. So we have this ambiguity about what that means, considers the rights and obligations of all creditors. What's even more surprising about the Bedcorp judgment is what the court has to say with respect to the question of insolvency. So basically, this decision concerned a voluntary winding up under Australian law, and the company was solvent when being wound up. There is no issue of material insolvency here. And Bedcorp struggled with this and said, well, that criterion, law relating to insolvency or the adjustment of debt, does not require the company to be either insolvent or to be contemplating using the provisions of the Australian law to adjust any debts. The Australian Corporations Act regulates the whole of the corporate life cycle, statutory ability to shift among various forms of dissolution, given changing circumstances. And then, remarkably, I think, the court says the Australian lawmaker thought that Chapter 5 of the Corporations Act would satisfy the criteria of the model law. So the insolvency requirement in terms of the company being technically insolvent is really done away with. It doesn't matter, actually. It doesn't play any role. So what we can take from BetCorp is U.S. courts think that the provisions implementing the model law apply if they are collective. For that to be the case, they must consider the rights and obligations of all creditors. Very vague term. No idea what that means. And secondly, there's no need for the company to be technically insolvent. Even a company that's technically fully solvent and is wound up voluntarily, that can be an insolvency proceeding for the purpose of international recognition. Now, Gold and Honey, the other case that I would like to mention here, the Eastern District of New York, 2009, receivership proceeding under Israeli law, it reinforces the interpretation the collectivity requirement has received in the BetCorp case, doesn't add anything to it, and it just gives some more detail as to the requirement that assets and affairs of the debtor are subject to control or supervision by a foreign court, and says that both the assets and the affairs of the debtor must be subject to control or supervision by a foreign court. So basically, what the Gold and Honey case does is it follows BetCorp on the collectivity requirement, meaning must consider rights and obligations of all creditors, no idea what it means, and is pretty strict on court control with respect to affairs and assets. What's also interesting is that since the Chapter 15 went into force, a couple of solvent UK schemes of arrangement have received recognition by the U.S. bankruptcy court. And that's important because a solvent scheme of arrangement typically does not affect all creditors. It affects only portions of the creditor community. And you may wonder how this can be reconciled with the stipulation that a proceeding is only an insolvency proceeding if it considers the rights and obligations of all creditors. Nevertheless, the U.S. bankruptcy court haven't had a problem to think it does, maybe because the term is so vague that everything can be subsumed under it. That is in stark contrast, by the way, to the approach of the German Federal Supreme Court that has been also confronted with this particular issue and has been pretty straightforward in saying that a solvent scheme of arrangement that does affect only certain creditors is not an insolvency proceeding, is not recognizable as an insolvency proceeding under German autonomous rules. So the German court is much more strict on collectivity. Well, what do we make out of all this? The U.S. case law, I submit, stresses the collectivity requirement, but is pretty lax with respect to its application. It considers. I've mentioned it many times. I don't know what to make out of this. And secondly, the material insolvency of the debtor is of no relevance with respect to the recognition issue. That was the case involving the Israeli receivership procedure. And if you take both the European approach and the recast insolvency regulation, and the approach in the United States implementing the model law together, I think what we see here worldwide is a trend that both the collectivity requirement with respect to what is an insolvency proceeding and the insolvency requirement with respect to qualifying something as an insolvency proceeding are relaxed. If this is so, however, one wonders what then is left in terms of hard criteria that can help us get an idea about when a proceeding shall be considered or characterized as an insolvency proceeding. So I submit that some kind of consistent conceptual or theoretical approach to the question, what is an insolvency proceeding, is missing. And let me give you, concluding this, a couple of ideas how I would approach the characterization problem, what I think is key to understanding what should, in an international context, be characterized as an insolvency proceeding with the question of universal recognition of its effects. Now, as a start, I think it should be noted that some kind of ontological approach to this particular issue doesn't make sense. There's no such thing as the insolvency proceeding or a nature of an insolvency proceeding. We just look hard at it and say, okay, if I focus hard and concentrate hard, then something emerges. This is an insolvency proceeding. So that does make sense. What is an insolvency proceeding is always a legal artifact. And because it is a legal artifact, it doesn't make sense to speak about the nature of an insolvency proceeding. Second preface to what I'm going to say is this. If you denominate something as an insolvency proceeding in a cross-border context, as such, the mere terminological issue, basically, is not central to the problem. What is central to the problem are the legal consequences that you associate with such dominant denomination and the circumstances under which such consequences can be justified. That's key to understand, I think, the question and give a reasonable answer to the particular question. Now, my answer that I would be giving hinges on differentiating two types of proceedings, basically. First of all, there are what I would call fully collective proceedings. Fully collective proceedings are proceedings that claim to affect all creditors worldwide of a debtor, regardless of the substantive law governing their claims and regardless of whether they have agreed to the jurisdiction of the courts of the opening state or not. So it doesn't matter whether in a contract, for example, that is the basis for a claim that you have against the debtor, you have chosen the law of the jurisdiction where proceedings are open to govern the contract, you are nevertheless affected by the proceedings. And it doesn't matter whether you've agreed in that contract to a dispute being litigated in that particular forum. So a fully collective proceeding claims to affect all creditors worldwide, regardless of these two other elements of the relationship between the creditor and the debtor. Now, what do I mean when I say claims to affect all creditors worldwide? I mean that in one form or another, individual rights enforcement of all creditors is restricted by the proceeding. Now, that can come in the form of procedural restrictions, for example, an automatic stay being imposed on all the creditors of a debtor. It can also come in the forms of substantive restrictions or modifications of the creditor's claims. For example, that reorganization or restructuring plan can be imposed on the creditors by majority vote, also against the will of the dissenting creditors. Now, as one example of such a fully collective proceeding, I would cite the German insolvency, the German insolvency proceeding under the Insolvency Code, if it is open as a main insolvency proceeding under the recast European Insolvency Regulation. Once that happens, the opening decision has universal effect, and that means also that there is an automatic stay under the German proceeding that has universal effect worldwide, a certain exception with respect to secured creditors that must not concern us here right now. And secondly, in the proceedings, creditors' claims can be compromised also against their will if there is a majority vote to adopt a particular restructuring plan. That's a fully collective proceeding. Now, there are, of course, then not fully collective proceedings. These are proceedings that don't claim to affect all creditors, but claim to affect only certain creditors or classes of creditors. Now, how does that play out with respect to the recognition and characterization problem? Now, fully collective proceedings are proceedings, as I've said, that claim to affect all creditors worldwide, regardless of whether the creditors have submitted to the forum of the opening of the proceeding and regardless of whether their claims are subject to the law of the jurisdiction where proceedings are opened. So the crucial question to answer is this: what justifies to counteract constraining legitimate creditor expectation as to forum and governing law? So what justifies it to bring somebody into a proceeding and have his or her claim being stayed or modified, even though that person has not agreed to the forum in which the insolvency, quote-unquote, proceeding is being conducted, and may also have stipulated that his or her claim is governed by a different law than those laws in place in the jurisdiction where proceedings are opened. Now, the answer, I think, to this particular question is the common pool problem. If you've got a situation where a particular proceeding aims at remedying or addressing the common pool problem of the creditors, then you have an extraordinary situation where it is really the case that all creditors sit in the same boat, and that justifies bringing them within the scope of a particular proceedings and having their claims stayed or compromised, even though they might not have voluntarily agreed to the forum and or the governing law. When do we have a common pool problem? Well, of course, in a situation of actual insolvency, but we may have it also, of course, much before actual insolvency, technical insolvency, because of backward induction. If I know that my fellow creditors are going to strike the day after tomorrow, I'm going to strike tomorrow, but everybody knows this, so I'm going to strike today. So we've got unraveling, and that means that we have a potential collective action problem also potentially a lot before material insolvency or the onset of material insolvency. Now, it is important to note that this common pool problem is not restricted to reorganizations. It's not the case that the problem with creditors trying to grab assets is a problem that only has to do with dissipating going concern value. That may be the case and probably is most often the case in a restructuring setting, but also if it is about a liquidation, racing to the asset can produce an equilibrium that is suboptimal compared to, for example, a deferred optimal liquidation, which makes sure that the assets are kept together for some period of time at least. So the issue here is this. Once a lawmaker addresses a common pool problem, and the answer of the lawmaker is a fully collective proceeding. The fully collective proceeding is the response of the lawmaker to the common pool problem. Then the lawmaker tries to remedy a situation which is so grave that the legitimate expectations of the creditors with respect to governing law and form of dispute resolution can be set aside or overcome, basically. So the argument runs as follows. A fully collective proceeding is a response to the common pool problem. Once the lawmaker produces a fully collective proceeding, the lawmaker remedies or tries to remedy a situation that is so grave that it is legitimately be said that all creditors sit in the same boat, and therefore it is legitimate to override their expectations with respect to governing law and dispute resolution forum and bring them under the umbrella of the proceedings and have the proceedings being recognized worldwide once they are initiated. Now, based on this test, for example, the German Insolvenzordnung, as I already said, is a fully collective proceeding and it should be considered to be an insolvency proceeding for the purposes of the question that I posed in the beginning of this talk. Same thing with respect to U.S. Chapter 11. No insolvency requirement here for initiating Chapter 11 proceedings, but an automatic stay, plus the possibility to compromise creditors' claims, also against the will of dissenting creditors. Therefore, insolvency proceedings. And I think the High Court was right in confirming this. There are other decisions, but that's a more recent decision that I cite here on that particular slide. Same thing with respect to French procédure de sauvegarde and procédure de sauvegarde accélérée. These proceedings do not allow bringing in all creditors with respect to a restructuring plan, but they have an automatic stay that affects all creditors. And that suffices because it is a procedural restriction on creditor rights enforcement. That suffices for considering that particular proceedings or these proceedings as insolvency proceedings. Now to conclude, of course, there are proceedings that are not fully collective proceedings in the sense that they do not affect all creditors either procedurally, automatic stay on all creditors, or substantively compromising or allowing compromises of creditors' claims. Typical examples would be a French procédure de sauvegarde financière accélérée, which doesn't stay all creditors' claims and concerns only portions of the debt that is outstanding. Typically, not fully collective proceeding is also a scheme of arrangement, as I already mentioned in the beginning. It concerns only, typically, particular classes of creditors' claims, and there's no automatic stay in the scheme of arrangement. Now, these proceedings are not fully collective, and because they're not fully collective, it is not the case that they attempt to address the general common pool problem of the creditors. And therefore, they are not insolvency proceedings. And therefore, the legitimate expectations of the creditors should be respected. That means, for example, for a scheme of arrangement, normatively speaking, if one were to reset the international legal framework, only those creditors should be bound by the proceeding that could have reasonably anticipated that their claims might be modified, which is to say only those creditors who have succumbed to the forum in which the scheme is being conducted by a contractual choice of jurisdiction clause, and who have also stipulated that their claims are governed by the law of the jurisdiction where the scheme is being conducted, i.e. in the UK. That means a scheme of arrangement with respect to a non-UK firm, for example, that applies only to certain classes of creditors would bind only these creditors who have contracted or that have contracted for the jurisdiction of English courts and English law is the law governing their claims. Now, I said that typically a scheme of arrangement affects only portions of the creditors. Now, there may be other circumstances, and there are other circumstances. So if a scheme of arrangement, for example, is done such that all creditors are affected by it, in the sense that creditors' claims are being modified by the effect of the scheme, then, based on the test I've just developed, it should be considered to be an insolvency proceeding, which means that the effects of the proceedings should extend to all the creditors, regardless of whether these creditors have agreed to an English forum, and regardless of whether these creditors have agreed to their claims being subject to English law. So the summing up of what I've just said goes as follows. What is an insolvency proceeding? That was the question that I posed at the beginning. I think it is a meaningful question only if one specifies the legal consequences associated with such characterization, asks whether under which circumstances these consequences are justified. Now, I've narrowed down the question to the problem of cross-border settings, and I've narrowed it down to the problem of recognition of proceedings in a cross-border setting. And if one does that, I submit the following conclusion and thesis. Insolvency proceedings are only those proceedings which attempt to address a common pool problem of the creditors. And those proceedings who do that are fully collective, because only fully collective proceedings attempt to address a common pool problem of the creditors, regardless of when and under which circumstances and which settings this common pool problem arises. This means that only proceedings that somehow restrict individual creditor rights enforcement should be considered to be insolvency proceedings in an international context for the purposes of recognition of these proceedings. And this restriction may be procedural in nature by an automatic stay, but it also can take the form of substantive modifications of creditor entitlements to which all creditors in principle are subject, even if they dissent. Thank you.